had their own special relationship. So,
Oscar.
Yeah, this is very emotional, but anyway, man, Birdie. So this is a tribute to Bert. And I put this image here because when I first heard about Bert, he was a smoke jumper. So he loved trees and wanted to save them. So I figured, put that in there. That was me a long time ago. And I came to work for Bruce. And I want to try to share some memories and teachings from Bert. And I also want to share one unique data set that actually wouldn't have been collected without John Wells or John Norman or Bert or this whole family here. In the 90s, I came to work with Bruce, and as you know, he worked for bioregenerative life support. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit of how Bert contributed to that whole effort. So this bioregenerative life support is a huge program, and it had been going on before I came. I came around here. And it was composed of university efforts, NASA centers, and you can see all the technologies that and the cropping systems, et cetera, with the goal to go to Mars, to the moon, and beyond, you know. And so I'm not going to talk about all this. What I'm going to talk about is this yellow line right here and this white line right here. And what's important is, in the yellow line, that's the line that got funded. Bruce came in here, you know, in the 80s. And the way NASA works is, if you're going to go and build something, well, you need to bring in technology. So there's a technology infusion points here from university and from industry. And like I said, Likor, Campbell, sensors, methods, ideas, everything. And so I came in here and started a master's, and right away I had some needs. And then later on, I started a PhD, and it got more complicated, and Bruce invited John and Bert for a couple-day workshop that was very intense, and I'm going to try to talk about some of that. I later on moved on to Kennedy here, and now I'm on this line over here, and somehow it ended, but we're still going. So anyway, at the Crop Physiology Lab, back in the 90s, we're studying plant responses in relevant spacecraft atmospheres. And I've come to this understanding now, you know, looking back. And if you look at the CO2 ranges we were trying to work with, you know, 300 to 10,000, maybe even higher, you know, the terrestrial global climate change is a little sliver somewhere in there. And so, you know, this really tries to study all this. And as we first came in, we wanted to do canopy gas exchange system. And I read the app 105, and I'm like, okay, maybe we can make that work. But, you know, everything that had been done was outside. And, boy, outside's scary because there's all these interactions and all these things. And, I mean, you can look at the agronomy people. Well, this year was wet, that year, next year was dry, and then we don't know what kind of happened. And it's tough. I mean, just the scale, the tractors, you know, all that kind of stuff, really, it's a very complicated thing. So, where's the pointer? So anyway, we wanted to build a canopy gas exchange system inside a chamber, and you can see little plants in there, 1 square meter and inside. And then the key technologies was the data acquisition, which, you know, at the time, Windows 3.1G, whatever, you know, and CO2 control systems. That's what we needed. We were working with 1,100 liters a minute. We wanted to control 300 ppm plus or minus 10, you know. something like that. So the big challenges there. The lighting systems, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm not going to talk about all that. I had worked with gas exchange before, so I had worked with Beano's analyzers and ADC, the automatic drip coffee machine that we call the ADCs, and on and on. And and then there was the LIGOR sensors, and I don't know how many times I've called you, John, but, you know, thanks for all the times you answered. And so the data acquisition, the CO2 control, Bert had a lot to do with that because we were doing all this with the data logger, CR10, then the CR10T, then all these multiplexers, and, you know, we had a lot of instrumentation in there. And then after that, for a PhD, you know, we even made it more complicated. We had another chamber. Oh, by the way, in this one, we could separate root zone and shoot respiration. I mean, and then we even made it more complicated because we want to go after canopy transpiration and energy balance in response to CO2. And so there was additional key technologies like anemometers and thermocouples and infrared transducers. So, and then this is Bruce. You know, it's always fun to see Bruce riding through a blizzard to go to work, man. So, let's say something about Bert. Well, he would motivate you and challenge you at the same time. And that is tough. I mean, I have a lot of students, and, you know, you can motivate them, you can challenge them, but, you know, he only did it, he'd look at you, and we've all heard all this. But he had that capability, and not everybody has the time to do that. That takes, you got to know the person in order to be able to do both things at the same time. And, you know, I ask people questions all the time, and about data loggers, biophysics, about this or that. And then, you know, he'd give you that look, and if he could tell you, he'd tell you. But if he couldn't, you know, well, he'd be quiet and disappear. But, like, kind of like Bertie said, maybe a week later, there would be a note on my desk, some scribbled paper, a reference or some comment, you know, that had what you had asked him. And what I'm thinking is he went to his desk and found it and got it and put it on your desk. And you should see my desk. And an example of one of these little notes was a 21X algorithm that he had, and for the, you know, and I modified it for the CR10 to do the CO2 mixing. And I still use it today. I mean, that's how powerful these little notes are, you know. I mean, the way he coded that 21X, I guess it didn't have many input locations, so, but anyway. So that was one ability for Bert. And then the other one is he'd be like, okay, let me do it, you know, because he could get it done quicker. And then you know that once he showed you how to do it, you'd be doing it forever. And, you know, he didn't need to be there anymore. And then, okay, I think John Norman and Larry have talked about this, but he always said, you know, I think we should dedicate a new SI unit of measure, and that is the NATSAS. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, the NATSAS, and it's been talked about earlier, and it's a convenient unit, you know, that it's a marriage between your known measurement error. So you got to understand your sensors. I'm a measurement guy. I measure stuff, you know, and you got to know the degree of error that you have, but the limitations of your instrumentation. But you also got to understand the degree of accuracy that your theory permits, you know. And so once you understand those two things, then you don't need to figure out the exact detail, because really, like in quantum mechanics, you can't, you know. But Bert always asked me to strive to measure things down to a gnat's ass. And he'd just say that. He didn't give me this explanation. I had to figure it out on my own. But once you do that, the type of thing that you measure, the data quality, is excellent, and the statistics, well, they become meaningless because you're really on the money, you know. So that's what I've learned from Bert. And so, anyway, I want to share that. And then there was technology development, you know, during that time in the 90s. Wrote a few papers with Bert. I mean, you know, I'm young scientist. You saw how young I was and stuff, but quantifying energy and mass transfer, crop canopies, sensors of measurement, temperature, and air velocity. And in this one, you know, some of the work is already taking place where, you know, the gauge of the wire, the thermocouple wire and the wind speed and the radiation it was in was affecting your measurements by several degrees if you weren't careful, you know. So and this is very important, you know, if you're going to measure things to the gnat's ass, because if you're not, then your error becomes too big. And then we also developed, you know, one day Bert showed up before that workshop that John came to, and, you know, he had one of Champ's wind tunnels and needle anemometers, and we were going to calibrate them, and here, you know. So we got that published, and I think, Bertie, you worked with some of that. I'm not sure. And then there was, we quickly figured out that the net radiometers were not good enough in the growth chambers to give us net radiation for energy balance measurements, because they had some problem with the long wave, too much long wave in the growth chambers, et cetera. So we started looking at trying to measure canopy temperature accurately, and then we looked at various sensors and heavy discussions over beer, and you know, and Bert was, give me one, I'll cut it in half, we'll find out how this thing works, you know. We'll just, how much are they? $100? Well, get one, cut it up, you know. Okay. So we were talking about the Exigen transducer, and, you know, we figured out that the sensor body temperature was somehow coupled to the temperature you're making. And, you know, John and Bird would come up, well, you need a black body calibrator, you need this, and then they would walk away, you know, and you got to figure it out. So that took a while, and we got it done, and, you know. We showed this one time at a conference, and we translated to millikelvins, actually, you know, because it's 0.00 degrees. You can really calibrate these things across a wide range of black body temperatures and also sensor body temperatures, you know. So anyway, that was crucial, and you know, there. A lot of people are enjoying the benefits of this, the technology development now. And so let's go measuring biophysical parameters. Well, I've taken classes from Larry, you know, and you got to have a construct in your head to how to do things. And I know that in the field there's all these complicating factors, but if you look at either a leaf or a vegetated surface, you have incident radiation, you have this boundary layer, you know, CO2 has to somehow cross that because there's a demand here for photosynthesis, there's a need for oxygen. If you don't supply enough oxygen, then things slow down. You have transpiration and has to, you know, escape out of that boundary layer, and there's also radiative heat transfer, and that's what you can measure with a infrared transducers. And then there's a buoyancy driven convection that really makes things easy here on the ground. But anyway, moving along, in order to view that boundary layer, it's hard to see it, so I've found some pictures of, you know, where you see some morning fog, and that's what's really going on and basically plants lose water and they humidify the air near them. And the surface conductance is proportional times the vapor pressure difference, you know, of at the VPD between the humidity at the surface and that and outside the boundary layer will give you the transpiration rate. And plants also close their stomates in response to increased CO2. So one of the questions we want to ask is, do stomates control canopy transpiration with a big chamber? And you have your plants, you have a shielded thermocouple. You know, I mean, it's important to say that, shielded, et cetera. You have infrared sensors. I'm not going to go through these, but the surface conductance has a physiological stomatal conductance and an aerodynamic conductance. Sorry, I got emotional, but I'm going to run through this. We developed a method for determining the aerodynamic conductance. Basically, you plot H versus the canopy to air temperature difference, and it doesn't go through zero, but if it does, it's the aerodynamic conductance for the canopy. And when you do that and you change the CO2 in the chamber, you see that transpiration decreases, stomatal conductance decreases. And so here I've plotted them as normalized as a function of CO2. So transpiration, first of all, let's look at the physiological response. It decreases like this up to a certain CO2 level where then transpiration starts responding to the difference in VPD between the bulk air and at the surface of the leaf. So I'm just going to conclude and say that stomata close and plants get hotter. Transpiration becomes more coupled to the bulk VPD. And the reduced stomatal control of canopy transpiration increases at a point somewhere around 800 ppm. And the kind of data that I presented here wouldn't have happened with Bert's help. So thanks.